are you not slamming into? Very few people have something deep in the ocean that they're afraid you're going to slam into. So as long as you stay in international waters, you could drop anything pretty much that you want, at least a few times, and get away with it. And that's what happened. I think he was loosely associated with the Bahamas, which is not the strictest organization country in the world. It'll be interesting to see. Apparently, everyone's family is going to sue whatever assets are left to sue, despite the fact that all these people signed that contract that basically said, you know, if we die, we die type of thing. A lot of times, legally, you can't just sign away your life that way. It depends upon a series of conventions. But, you know, if the person killing you is found to be completely incompetent, even if you write a note saying it's okay for him to kill me, it's not okay for him to kill you. So my guess would be his family is going to lose a significant portion of the family wealth that he was born to, that his father was born to, that his grandfather was born to, that his great-grandfather was born to. So much for the idea of a you make your future, not that you're born into it.
Did it come back that it was the fatigue of the carbon fiber that, you know, it expanded and contracted too many times? Is that what caused it?
So far, it's my understanding that it's unclear. It's kind of indicative by the fact that many people in previous dives heard this crackling noise, and one of the primary reasons most people posit that these people heard crackling noises was that the substance of the carbon fiber is not a solid material. It is fibers of carbon arranged in a non-symmetrical way. They go in every which way, and they're embedded in epoxy. So it's a very amorphous, very random structure. One version of carbon fiber tube is different than another. But when pressure differentials, and the problem is carbon fiber is terrible for compression. It's good for tensile strength, but it's terrible for compression. And this is a lot of compression. That when a lot of compressive force hits carbon fibers, the epoxy peels away from the carbon fiber, and so you're getting weakening cycle after cycle. As I said before, as far as the documentation, there were alarms in the submersible. They didn't really get into the detail of what the sensors were indicating, but it was probably pressure stress on the carbon fibers, and then the electrical systems failed. Keep in mind, the electrical systems were all designed and built by college students. So this is the type of professional outfit you're talking about.
Yeah, anybody's interested in this, you should go on YouTube and just search for James Cameron and then the word Titanic, and you'll see how to do it right, how they did it right.
Well, among other things, they used, I believe, titanium. They used a solid alloy with a few seams so that there were less failure points, and it was a uniform a material that could and was tested repeatedly. I believe it was designed more spherically, which is able to deal with pressure better than a tube, but you can throw more paying customers into a tube than you can a sphere. So just about all of the submersible/submarine/Titanic crazy people out there kept on yelling and screaming, but no one heard them. You could actually look this stuff up before the disaster. It wasn't as prevalent as it is now, but it was available for people to see. A lot of comments of people saying, you're going to get people killed. And his response was, don't waste my time telling me I'm going to get people killed. Great last words.
WB2BXO with a comment?
Yes, Frank.
Yeah, Roy, I heard you key, but I didn't hear any audio go up. Would you like me to go ahead?
Yes, I'm sorry. That's strange because it looks like something registered, but yeah, please do.
Okay, very good. I mean, you're serving as net control, so I didn't just want to jump in. Anyway, I think my first reaction to what you're saying is I think leadership people would say is the most one of the most important aspects of any system is the human factor and the human resources involved. And without really knowing very much about it, I'd say you pinpointed the difference right there. Is James Cameron's system was designed and built by professionals who had many years' experience, and the Titan system was built by college interns. Who I'm sure had the best of intentions, but just didn't have the experience, and had no business doing it without adult supervision, so to speak. So I think in the end, it's the human resources and the leadership that failed as much or more than the technology. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, ultimately, the rationale for why he got college students to do his engineering, and there's really no indication Boeing had anything to do with this, although he had mentioned Boeing. You know, maybe he passed a Boeing engineer in the street and said, what do you think about submersibles or something? But the reason for the hires, the reason for the tubes, the reason for the carbon fibers was pretty much one thing, was to keep it cheaper than the stuff that was actually safe. So he decided that he would scrimp on safety in order to attain profit. You know, the ultimate in capitalism, I guess, gone crazy. But, you know, it's unfortunate that he had to take other people with him. You know, if he kind of got lost himself, then so be it. But I feel bad for members of the families of the people who passed away. You know, even though they mostly knew what they were doing, hopefully, it still, you know, doesn't make a person's death any easier to deal with.
Yeah, it does remind me of down here, one of the local business schools had a program where they were sending out, forming teams of freshmen interns, first year undergraduate business students, to go out to the local nonprofits and do consulting. And I remember their work product from the organization I was working on was well-intentioned, but not all that helpful. But I believe the school ultimately discontinued the program, probably for the same reason that the nonprofits were not finding the consulting all that helpful from students in their first year undergraduates. So, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, practices like that in colleges, maybe they're well-meant, but they're the basis in a lot of charlatan technology. What happens is someone will kickstart an idea, you know, of almost unlimited extracting water from the air. They'll find a local college where the engineering department is looking for some kind of notoriety, and they'll get a couple of interns from that place, and they'll kind of mutually kind of navel gaze and talk themselves into things that has no chance in being useful. You know, you think of the guys who came up with the nonsense of a solar paneled road of basically dehumidifiers somehow efficiently and in dry environments extracting gallons and gallons of water. You got other lunatics who have who think that they're going to have a dryer based on a vacuum drying that's low energy, even though the amount of energy required to actually vacuum out water vapor is enormously high. And you just have, it goes on and on. And a lot of them have figured this scam where you partner with a local college and then you represent yourself as part of that research university and take a lot of money from optimistic people who don't understand what technologies don't really work.
Yeah, that's kind of, I hear where you're coming from. That's actually a different kind of program than the one I was talking about where the school was sending out the students to local social service nonprofits. That wasn't even technical, and it still wasn't very productive. Anyway, I've got to do some other things here, but I will be listening off and on for a while. Thanks, Roy. WB2BX, sir.
Okay. You're welcome, Frank. Thank you again for participating. We're coming close to the close of this segment, but I will throw out a story that is in my link page that Paul mentioned that he thought was interesting. So I'll share a very, very short summary of it, and if anyone wants to comment, so be it. Some Japanese researchers a few years ago discovered that, I think it was mice, lab mice, that had mutated and broken a gene that codes for a protein very common in mammals called USAG1, was producing excessive amounts of teeth. You know, it would just keep growing teeth. So they decided that this might be a real thing. And they discovered that a way to mimic that mutation was going to be antibodies that were designed to destroy protein USAG1. The idea being that that protein seems to interact in the mice body to block it from keeping to cycle teeth. As we all know, we have some milk teeth maybe when we're born that grow. We then have baby teeth that erupt, and then, you know, when you're 10 to 14, 15, your adult teeth erupt. At that point, though, the regulating systems shut that factory down, and you stop growing teeth, and so you start losing teeth. Let me drop for a sec. So the idea is this is a antibody that's going to block a protein that's going to allow mammals, hopefully, to grow more teeth. They're thinking of testing it out on, they said, human beings. They're not going to test it out on people who have lost their teeth due to gum infections and what have you. They're first going to test it out on human beings who have a genetic inability to grow teeth, anodynia something. So they're going to test it on people who've never had teeth. If it shows itself to be of value and it gets approved for that, they'll go into further studies of seeing if this is the golden goose of doing something and regrowing teeth that have rotted away instead of getting plugs or dentures. You'll actually be able to get a third version of your teeth pop up. So that's the story. Right now, again, it's very early. The Japanese are working on it, and it's special cases of people with genetic predisposition of not growing teeth at all. So I thought it would be interesting. If anyone has any comments, feel free.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Okay, yeah, thanks for that. I wanted your opinion. But when I first read that, I said, oh, this can't be real. And so now I clicked on a couple of other websites, and one of them went a little further. They said after treating adults with with that condition you talked about, if that works, they're going to try it with little kids that are born like that. And then from there, you know, they're looking at, they said that maybe 20, 30,
for that, you know, it's a long way off, and who knows how many years after that it would take. Maybe, I'm guessing, another decade before they could actually do it with people that have lost teeth. But an incredible story. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, I agree. It's an incredible story. It's not going to be, unfortunately, for us old-timers. By the time they get anything useful, if they ever get anything useful, I always caution people that just because some preliminary studies are suggestive that it might work, you never know. Right now, they tested, apparently, the antibodies, and they're not detrimental to lab animals or such. So you never know. It might happen. And just in case people think how weird it is to have teeth kind of coming out of nowhere, there are certain very, very weird stem cell cancers in which they will form all kinds of bits and pieces of the human body in the body of the tumor. You'll take the tumor out, you'll cut it up, you'll get hair follicles with hair growing in it, you'll get bits of teeth in it. So this, because it's a very primitive stem cell, it doesn't have the instructions for the whole body turned off yet. So when it becomes malignant and just grows very rapidly, it grows into all kinds of different cell lines and different kind of bits and pieces of organs. So it's not as incredibly far-fetched as people might think it is, because they think of teeth, no doubt, as a highly sophisticated, structured unit that, you know, requires a lot of things to build it. But it's surprisingly not that difficult. Getting it in the right place to the right degree, that's very difficult. Okay, I think we've had enough of that. Once again, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight in our technical net. I can't do this by myself, so I really appreciate everyone who helps me along with questions and answers and comments and what have you. And I hope that you'll join us all next Sunday when we do it all over again, starting at 8 o'clock. But now at 10:21, it's as good a time as any for the SpaceNet Report with WS2M.
Okay, thanks, Roy. H2G, SWS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. And there was a launch last week by the Chinese, actually a Chinese private company called Land Space. And this is their second try of trying to orbit. The reason I bring it up, I mean, they've launched a lot of rockets, the Chinese. You know, they're almost catching up to the United States with the amount of rockets that they launch. But this one was special because it had liquid methane and liquid oxygen, liquid methane for fuel, instead of the RP-1, which is rocket propellant number one, which is basically a refined kerosene. That's the most common fuel. Or hydrogen, liquid hydrogen is another one. But there's been a competition by a bunch of companies trying to do this, trying to get a methane rocket to, you know, into orbit. And some of them have tried to launch, and they make it almost to orbit, and then something goes wrong with the second stage or something with it. They haven't been successful, including this company. They tried it once half a year ago, but now this time they were successful. So it looks like the Chinese won. There's other companies that have been trying to do this, including SpaceX, Starship, and then there's the ULA, United Launch Alliance, which is really Boeing and Lockheed. They're building the new Vulcan rocket, which is going to replace the Delta IV and eventually the Atlas V rocket. And that's also going to be a liquid methane rocket, and that will be driven by 2BE4 liquid methane engines being built by Blue Origin. Now, Blue Origin would love to have a success either with that or with their own rocket. They're building the New Glenn rocket, which would eventually have half a dozen of these, seven of these BE4 engines on the bottom of their New Glenn rocket, which, by the way, New Glenn is probably almost as big as the Saturn V rocket. It's a very heavy lift rocket that Blue Origin is building. And then there's a couple of more. The Rocket Lab presently launches the Electron rocket, which is very successful. They've been doing that since, 2017. But they're also building the Neutron rocket. The Neutron rocket will be another reusable liquid methane rocket. And that one's being the first one anyway. Well, he's setting up a production plant in the state of Virginia. And then one other one, which I just tried recently, is the Taran R that's built by Relativity Space. That's also going to be a reusable rocket. Also liquid methane, liquid oxygen. So they all kind of wanted to be the first to make it to orbit. But it looks like the Chinese won out. SpaceX almost had them with that last one back in April 20th with Starship, but we all know what happened to that. If you listen to the net or the news, that thing blew up. They blew it up on purpose because it was not going right. Second stage did not separate. Any comments? WS2M.
Get BB2BX with a question.
WB2BXO, sure. Go ahead, Frank. WS2N.
Yeah, Paul, isn't there some question as to whether the FTS, the flight termination system, actually worked? Whether the thing just blew up when the second stage, when the staging didn't work, or has it been resolved that the FTS did eventually work, even though it didn't work on the first try? Go ahead.
I read, probably a month ago that it did work, but it didn't work soon enough. They needed to, From what I understand, they detonated from the ground. It should have detonated by itself. They have these let's call them GPS type trackers inside these new rockets. All the Falcon 9s have them, and then now the Vulcan, when that goes up, they're all going to have this this tracker, the Electron rocket from Wallops Island. And if it goes off course one way or another, it's supposed to set off the FTS, the flight termination system. And they have explosives, running down the sides of these tanks, the oxygen tanks and the fuel tanks. And this way, when it blows up, it splits the tanks, like a zipper. So, that kind of an explosion, that looks like what they had. So I'm guessing that was, caused from the FTS. But to confirm it, Frank, I really haven't read anything that confirmed it. I just assumed that when they said that it was detonated from the ground. Back to you, Frank.
Okay, so the primary FTS system, the automated system, apparently didn't work, but the backup worked. I remember hearing at some point that was one of the things that the FAA was upset about, is that the FTS didn't work properly. All right, very good, Paul. Go ahead, WB2BN stuff.
I know the government is forcing them to do something different, whatever that might be. With the FTS system. And years ago, this is actually a relatively new thing with the FTS being automatic. Before SpaceX, they didn't have that. They had two systems. The main one was, somebody on the ground would detonate it. But then they also had another one, like with the Apollo, they had a wire that ran from the top, from the third stage all the way down to, and that actually, I think, two wires, two different locations. And if they both broke, that would have created a massive explosion. So they did have that. That was their idea of something like that. The wire would also ignite there's a lot of different ways of doing it. Would ignite the solid booster the rockets on the launch abort system. That's located on top of the Apollo spacecraft. And they had the same thing as, for the Mercury system. They didn't have it for Gemini. There was no launch abort system for Gemini. I'm sure SpaceX will straighten MS out. That thing was around. I remember watching that live, and looked like it started circling around. That thing should have been off a lot earlier. WS West. Okay. Talking about Blue Origin, by the way, that's the company that's owned by Jeff Bezos. He's the one that's creating these BE-4 engines. He's got a bunch of engines he's actually creating. He's got the BE-4 for the Vulcan rocket and the soon-to-be New Glenn rocket. He's got the BE-1 engine. That's the one that they use for liquid hydrogen for the New Shepard that goes up the moon. That's grounded, but they did say they're going to start reflying that very soon. You put a crew of half a dozen people in there and you make a suborbital flight with a BE-1 engine. That engine has been very, very reliable in that booster. It's only one engine, but very reliable. They plan on eventually using that as a possible third stage on the New Glenn rocket. So that's important down the road. And then you have the BE-7 engine that Blue Origin is also building. It's a little different. It's a hypergolic type system that he's building for the Blue Moon, lunar lander that he's now contracted with NASA. NASA finally gave him a contract to be one of the contractors. Well, he's teaming up with another company that was Lockheed, as well as Honeywell, to build a lander that will land people on the moon, starting with probably Artemis 5. But he's got that, and they're all slightly different engines. But they're getting pretty good at building them. Well, one of the BE-4s that were being developed, he's got a test facility in West Texas where he tests all these things. And the news got a hold of this one story about a month or so ago. One of the engines blew up in the test stand. And they said it affected everything. The companies that are involved, the stock market, because they were saying, oh, their engine blew up, and this is the one that they've been working on for, you know, 10 years. But it turns out that they test engines there all the time. In fact, this one engine that blew up was tested 14 different times, 14 different ways, different pressures, different temperatures, different stresses on it, different gimbling hookups to it. They've tried everything, and they do this with a lot of the engines that are coming out of that factory. But, you know, because the one engine did blow up, that created bad press for Blue Origin. And but then, they did make a statement. Jeff Bezos did make a statement saying that this is not going to affect the timeline on Vulcan. It's not going to affect the timeline on New Glenn. Hopefully they keep on going. It's true. None of these engines, the B-4 engines, have yet to make it to orbit. But I think that day is coming soon. They've got a couple of thousand hours, they said, of testing on, you know, collective testing on B-4 engines. And they seem to have it down packed. They were putting the one that blew up through, different kinds of stress environments that they wouldn't normally fly it in, and sure enough, it blew up on a stand. Any comments? WS2N for the Space Net Report. Okay, talking about engines. All right. Aerojet Rocketdyne, they've been around like forever. They're developing a new new thruster system for the Gateway space station that will eventually be built and will eventually, you know, have a crew on a regular basis orbiting the moon. This Gateway space station is going to have regular thrusters on it too, but one of the things that they're going to put on is these new nickel and SEP thrusters, solar electric systems, very commonly used nowadays. A lot of your geosynchronous satellites have SEPs on it, where they'll launch to orbit, but they'll be, maybe a month away from actually getting to a geosynchronous orbit, and they have these solar electropropulsion engines that come on and they stay on and they just don't shut off for, as long as they want. They can keep running it. The thrust is so minimal, but it's thrust. And over time, they eventually accelerate to where they want to go. All these SEP engines and Hall effect engines, these things have been tested. Oh, I don't know, it's got to be 20 years now. I remember the SMART, they called it the SMART satellite that went out to, had one on it, and I think that was from the European Space Agency. Dawn had one. Dawn went out to an asteroid, Ceros, and then eventually another asteroid, and then it actually orbited the asteroid, and then would actually deorbit, after a couple of years, and go to another asteroid and go into orbit around that. And eventually wound up around Cirrus, and then it's still in orbit around that asteroid today. Using these electric propulsion type engines, they're really, really reliable. They come on, they'll stay on for sometimes thousands and thousands of hours, months at a time. And you take like Dawn. Dawn had three of them on, three engines, but they would only fly one at a time. They'd fly one for a couple of months, and then, that would shut off, another one would come on. they did have three going at one time. The difference here is the Aerojet Rocketdyne company is planning on putting three of these things on the Gateway space station. The difference between the ones they're working on now and the older versions is these are three times more powerful. Each one is three times more powerful than the existing ones, which is going to help because, you know, they plan on pushing a lot down in orbit around the moon. And the ISP, that's the number that they go by to determine, you know, how efficient these things are very, very high, you know, 400 or 500, whatever it might be. So the efficiency is just terrific, just so little fuel that you're going to need. You know, every Starlink satellite that has been put up by SpaceX has a SEP on it as well. Every one of them. And from what I understand, they really haven't had any failures with those little thrusters. You know, and they run on different fuels. The earlier ones ran on Krypton fuels for SpaceX, and now they switched over to argon. You know, different fuels are less expensive, and they're just getting better at this stuff. Any comments? Put in at WS2N. Forgot to put my fan on to keep my radio cool. Just did that. The company I mentioned earlier, Rocket Lab, they launched the Electron rocket on a regular basis since 2017. I think they're probably up to around 40 different launches. The they have now three launch complexes. They have two launch complexes in New Zealand, and now they have another one in Virginia, in Wallops Island, Virginia, from the United States. So they are launching so many rockets, and, you know, the owner of the company, Peter Beck, he needs to either increase the factory to be able to push out more of these things, because, he has so many different launches on the manifest that he can't keep up, or he needs to switch to reusability. And he's, in the last year or two, he's been trying to do just that. He wanted to have the rocket, the first stage, actually come through the atmosphere with a parachute. He's using a parasail. They're very directional. You could guide them, need them to go. And then his plan was to catch it with a helicopter, with a hook. And then the helicopter was supposed to bring it to the deck of a ship, and then in turn bring it back for reusability. And that really hasn't worked out. They tried the helicopter actually twice. Well, one time they grabbed it, and the guy flying it realized the stresses were too much, and he released it. So now they've actually given up with the idea of not reusability, but using the helicopter. So the next flight that goes up, they're going to have it come down, land in the water, and now different kind of parachute to make a softer landing in the water. It waterproofed everything around the engines, anything that, you know, where salt water could get in. They've gone overboard, they said, with trying to protect the first stage. And then, if it's successful, I think probably in a couple of weeks, whenever they not a rocket, it'll land in the water. And then, in fact, the ship that pick it up design that so they could more carefully pick it up at two locations instead of one, and that'll help everything. So they're doing a good job with that, and then if that's successful, they're going to bring it back. And then there's nine engines on the bottom of the rocket. They call them Rutherford engines. And by the way, it's a unique design. They don't have pre-burners or anything like that, spinning up these turbines to, 50 and 100,000 RPMs. What they use is electric motors. And electric motors, they have them tied to lithium-ion batteries. So anyway, there's a lot of electronics involved with this, and they said that they're going to protect everything. It's going to land in the water, they're going to pick it up, bring it back, and if everything looks good, they're going to take at least one engine, just to say they've done it, and reuse that on a future flight, just one of the nine engines. And of course, if that goes well, then they'll start doing it on a regular basis. There are some payloads that they launch that are, either on a head or more demanding, where they have to go to a higher orbit, more difficult orbit to go to. And if they have that, then they just won't use the reusability capability of the Electron rocket. They'll just, give it the gas and let it wind up in the ocean. And that's the story with that. Any comments? Nothing heard. The Bepi Colombo spacecraft that was launched quite a while back, I believe it was probably about 5 years ago now, from French Guiana. They launched it on an Ariane 5 rocket, and its goal is to actually orbit Mercury. But to do that, it has to do a lot of flybys. It has to go all the way around the sun and then use either the planet Mercury or even Earth or Venus to slow it down, depending on how you approach a planet. You could either use that planet's ability to accelerate the vehicle, or you could use the planet's gravity to slow it down. When you're going in all the way especially into Mercury, the idea is actually to slow the speed down relative to the sun. So you need to get this thing down to a very slow speed, because to get to the speed that Mercury is going around the sun compared to what Earth is doing now. When we go around the sun, I think it's something like 66,000 miles per hour. That's how fast we're going around the sun. So you've got to slow that down to basically a crawl to get around, to go into orbit around Mercury. So that's what they do every year. It's actually less than a year now, but every time they go around the sun, they go in front of another planet, including Mercury, to slow it down. But when they get past Mercury, because it's a Mercury mission, they turn on all the cameras, all the equipment, and sure enough, they have pictures coming back of Mercury. Goal, I think, is to do it by 2028 or something like that. A couple of years now, 2025, I think it was. A couple of years from now, they should make it into orbit around Mercury. It'll be the second spacecraft to actually have done that. NASA did it many years ago with the Messenger spacecraft, and that was very successful in what it did. But you need a very large rocket to to take a relatively small payload to slow it down to do that. They used the Delta IV Heavy for the Parker Solar Probe years ago to do the same thing. The Parker Solar Probe goes near the sun, but you had to slow that thing down tremendously to get it into orbit, a tight orbit around the sun. Incredible. Any comments? Okay, the Artemis program is moving along, and there's a lot of infrastructure that's built for it. NASA's still well-funded for that, although they are taking a hit on science missions in the future. They're unfortunately being cut. Instead of increasing their budget, they're slightly decreasing it. But the manned space program is still going full blast. Now they have three Artemis spacecraft, or Orion spacecraft, that's part of Artemis being worked on at the same time. They have Artemis 2, 3, and 4 down in Florida in one of the buildings, and they are all in different stages of construction. But it's good to see that. And one of the items that I thought was pretty good that they brought in, I mean, I think they're ahead of schedule, is these vehicles that they're going to use to move the crew and workers, tech workers, from the building where the astronauts don their spacesuits before they launch. They have to go on this like 9-mile ride to Launch Complex 39B. So they're going to use these new vans that they bought from a company called Canoo, K-A-N-O-O. I'm just going to look up to see what else they made. So for some reason they got the contract with NASA to make these things. They look like three big, I want to say not SUVs, they're more like vans, more like full-size vans. They're very nice looking, and they're all electric. They're keeping with the green pace of everything else that's going on in the world. So anyway, they shipped them in, but I think they're way early. I don't expect the launch of Artemis 2 crew to go up until the earliest the end of next year, the end of 2024. But hopefully they keep to that schedule and they're able to do that. That's going to be the first crew. They've already got the crew chosen. They'll be on the moon, go about 6,000 miles past the moon, and eventually return back to Earth. The idea is to confirm all the human resources that will be needed for four people to survive a trip to the moon and back. And in this case, it'll be a 10-day trip. Not like the last one was a shakedown trip of the Orion spacecraft around the moon. That took 28 days. Originally planned for 39 days, but they eventually shortened it to 28 days because of all the delays, the changed window, time frame, and all of that. Any comments? This is WS-12. Okay, not much else. SpaceX keep launching, it seems like every other day, another rocket, and most of their launches have to do with the Starlink missions. They keep putting an average of 50 satellites, each one weighing around 500 or 600 pounds, on a regular basis. They now have like 4,350 satellites, I think, some number like that, in orbit. And they just keep on doing it. Talk about running out of boosters to use. Their big thing is reusable boosters. You know, when they first made them, we'll make it for 5 launches. That's what we're gonna get the most out of the Falcon 9. Well, that eventually turned into 10, and now it's in this case it's number 16. 16 times this thing has flown and landed successfully, of course. So they've really come a long way with the reusability. And it really did drive the price down, and it's affecting the world market. You know, and they're all trying to cut their prices to stay competitive. Any other comments for the net? Okay, nothing else heard. We're going to turn it back to Roy. I just wanted to mention one thing, that this Thursday, my mark that will be on the air from the Cradle of Aviation on July 20th for the 54th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. They do this every year, and they set up a table, and they set up a couple of radio stations. I think they said they're going to have a FT8 there, as well as a phone station. I didn't hear anything about a CW station. But they'll be there. I think they arrive like 9 o'clock or so. Anyway, we're going to turn it back to you, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N for the Space Net Report for the Technet.
This is AC2GS. Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do on the TechNet and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it, and I appreciate it especially, as I do appreciate everyone who participated tonight. If Alan is still listening, I guess Alan usually leaves after a while. I looked up if there were any BBSs packed around, and there's this really sad Facebook page that says Long Island Packet Radio Club, and it has something like 10 posted messages in a year, and most of them had nothing to do with packet radio. So I think at least locally, packet is, if not dead, taking a very, very, very deep sleep. Anyway, thanks to everyone. I, again, do appreciate it. Our revels now are done, and I usually end this with a couple of quotes. So Dick used to end his TechNet with the suggestion, be kind to each other, and I think that's always good advice, so please keep it in mind. I like to mention Epictetus. Good old Epictetus' big quote was, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open, and try and learn something new every so often. You know, what can you do? You know, it's always a good thing. It stimulates the brain. So please, everyone, have a great week, and try and come back next Sunday at 8 when we'll try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net. Slava Ukraine. I am clear.
Roy, great net as usual, WB2BX.